This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Recently, a close friend of mine experienced an unexpected loss. Watching their family struggle emotionally and financially made me stop and think seriously about my own family's future. As the primary provider, I know how important it is to make sure that if anything ever happened to me, my family would still be able to manage. So I realized that without life insurance, my family would be left with overwhelming financial burdens. I looked into coverage before, but the process always felt complicated, got endless forms, phone calls, and medical exams, made everything take weeks. So that's why Ethos stood out to me. Their process is simple and 100% online. There's no medical exam required, just a few health questions, and you get a quote in as little as 10 minutes. In many cases, you can even receive same-day coverage without ever leaving your house. Ethos offers up to $3 million in coverage, with some policies starting as low as $2 a day, billed monthly. It's a trustworthy company that's changing the way people think about life insurance. So protect your family's financial future with life insurance from Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Brian. That's ethos.com/Brian. Application times may vary. Rates may vary.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade Show. What a week we've had. I came up to me before and said, how was Thanksgiving? And I thought, this year? I mean, it does seem like 2 years ago, Thanksgiving. It's just how crazy things are these days with the stories breaking out of the White House, in and around Venezuela. You factor in what's going on with the capture of the would-be bomber on January 6th of 2021, finally getting the guy. There's just so much going on. Brett Baer is standing by, Gerard Baker, editor-at-large of the Wall Street Journal, bottom of the hour. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
You commit crimes, you go to jail. Doesn't matter what your race is, what your ethnicity, religion. But demonizing the entire group of people by their race and their ethnicity is something I was hoping we'd never have to see.
Governor Tim Walz, life should take advice from you. Bigger than anyone thought. The Minnesota $1 billion social services scam is turning out to be bigger than anyone could have imagined. Fingers are pointing to the Somali community headed by Ilhan Omar, including one of her top aides arrested. We have the story most of the media is choosing to ignore.
Number two.
This issue raises what really is a classic in the literature about use of force. And there's extensive discussion by lawyers, thoughtful people at the time, about what morality requires you to do in wartime. That kind of debate is what we need to be having now. And instead, it's beginning to be the usual sharp disagreement between Republicans and Democrats.
I hear you, but Washington Post David Ignatius, there's only really one person causing an argument. The Republicans never argued with President Obama when he was killing terrorists for 8 years to the tune of 575 times, sometimes double taps, sometimes triple taps. Drug boat bombing explained off the coast of Venezuela as Dems foolishly just won't let it go. We bring you the post-game briefing that should have answered all the questions.
Number one.
Now, Trump's economic plans has always been very, very simple. Cut taxes, cut regulation, and make energy cheaper. The one thing he can't do on this tour is tell people things are great for them when they're not.
They're about to be. That's what the focus should be, Byron York. Game plans hatched for the Dems and Republicans. The bud words for both affordability, as Dems will make sure the country is unaffordable by causing it, and the GOP is in a race to fix it as Trump takes the wheel for the last time, eyeing the midterms, and which will be a quality final 2 years of his administration or a frustrating one as they go for investigations and who knows, maybe even impeachment. By the way, the big thing happening in Washington today is the World Cup draw. What is significant about that? Every team is in the hopper, 48 teams. They're all going to play a guaranteed 3 games. There's going to be over 100 games around the country, 144. And it's really going to be across the country, Mexico and Canada. And they're expected to be 1 billion people watching. Brett Baer, more of a golfer than soccer fan, but will he be watching the World Cup? That is the only reason why we booked him. To find out about his soccer fandom and passion, Brett, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely will be watching, and it'll be on Fox. I think my kids are way into it.
Really?
I'm getting into it. Yeah.
Compare that to where you were in 94 when it was here before. Did you even know what was happening in 94?
I'm pretty sure I knew it was happening. I think I went to a bar in Washington at one point early in the morning and watched all these people cheering. I think it's exciting. I think it's going to be an amazing thing for the country with all the things that are happening with the 250th. And then you've got the World Cup, and you know it's a fun event tonight because they do this draw with the president of Mexico and the Canadian Prime Minister and President Trump, and I think it's going to be great.
I think it's going to be great. It's going to be also good. Maybe we can get a trade deal out of it with everybody in the same room because we do have to update USMCA. So yesterday the big drama was the admiral who called up the double tap off the coast of Venezuela September 2nd, was able to explain himself, and nobody was able to confirm that Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War, said, kill everybody. So Democrats must have been frustrated on that. So after watching it and the follow-up strike, Senator Tom Cotton said this, cut 25.
I want to thank Admiral Bradley and General Kane for coming to brief about the strikes on September 2nd, which were righteous strikes. These are narco-terrorists who are trafficking drugs that are destined for the United States to kill thousands of Arkansans and millions of Americans. The first strike, the second strike, and the third and the fourth strike on September 2nd were entirely lawful and needful, and they were exactly what we'd expect our military commanders to do.
So he's chairman of Armed Services and a former, he's a veteran, an infantry member. Senator Chris Coons, in the same briefing, same question, 27.
Did you come away with that same impression?
I did not.
Well, how do you guys come up with such different conclusions?
I don't know.
What do you think's the reason they have such different conclusions, Brett Baer? Think about it for a second. Don't rush to answer.
They're on both sides of the aisle.
Thank you.
Opposite sides. I think, you know, Senator Cotton was very specific, and he answered the question at length. He kept on going, and he was asked, you know, was there a kill or all order from Secretary Hegseth? And he said no, that the Admiral Bradley was clear that that was not given, no such order to give no quarter or kill them all. And then, you know, there's this debate about whether the guys were really getting back on the boat and flipping it over to try to save the rest of the drugs and call their guys to pick them up. I mean, I don't understand why Republicans can say, I saw that, and the admiral could say that, but Democrats could say, I saw two innocent people struggling to stay alive. I don't get it.
I don't give them a pass on it. That's one time when you're on those committees, intelligence and armed services, you almost think they're a cut above. And Senator Warner was just as bad. Coons was semi measured. But Jim Hines was absolutely painting the most ridiculous picture as if he was shaken to the core. And I think the analogy works. It was written up. We talked about it on this show. Mark Thiessen wrote about it. You cannot be outraged by these strikes. And at the same time, President Obama did not want to fill up Gitmo. So he was killing terrorists through drone strikes for 8 years to the tune of over 500 people. The guy was blowing up weddings, innocent people. A lot of times they didn't survive the first strike, so he went at them again with a second. Human Rights Watch chronicled it. Stanford did a study on it. So this is a fact. I mean, do Democrats even acknowledge that?
Yeah, I don't. They don't talk about it, and I think they should have been asked after that hearing about that very question.
So the thing is, looking at the big picture, the president's got a lot of assets in the area, and he's waiting for one thing to happen: Maduro to go. You know, there's a lot of speculation in Miami and other places that when he disappears for a day or two, they think he escaped. The president reportedly offered him, "You can leave with your family, go somewhere else. You can't stay." If he stays, it looks like he won. So there might be a little pressure on the administration led by this operation. It seems to be led by National Security Advisor Rubio. So your thoughts about how this plays out, Brett, as time wears on?
Well, I mean, I do think that this was a giant pressure campaign to get to Maduro. And, you know, whether he takes a golden parachute and goes someplace that Russia and China would like him to go, or that's the end result of all this buildup. I think if you're going to say we're going to do land operations soon, you can only say that for a few days before you do land operations.
And that's what the president said.
We're getting to that point now. And it's one way or the other. I think if I had to bet, I would say Maduro takes the cue, but I don't know.
I know it's interesting because you have some Republicans like Rand Paul who are going to bring legislation up to essentially to call off this whole operation and incite the War Powers Act. Are there any of the Republicans joining that in the Senate that you know of?
I don't. I don't know of any other Republicans besides Rand Paul. I know the Democrats will be on, and Tim Kaine is leading it with Rand Paul. And it'll be an authorization bill that essentially says the administration has to come to Congress for authorization for a land attack in Venezuela. And the president will say it's well within his right to do what he's doing.
Brett Baer, our guest. And by the way, his book is a perfect Christmas gift to rescue the American spirit, Teddy Roosevelt and the birth of a superpower. And of course, you have the Brett Baer podcast. But the book is great, especially because bestseller. You're guaranteed people will know about it in your family, especially if you're a Brett Baer fan. And you can get it now. So you got a couple of weeks. So Brett, just talking about affordability, both sides are embracing it. Is one side is saying it's the Republicans' fault that the prices are high, and the Republicans say, "Are you kidding me?" Here's J.D. Vance, cut four.
And I think the next year in American growth and American prosperity could be the best year that we've had in the United States of America. It's going to happen because we're all working hard. It's going to happen because we have the greatest country in the world. But I think for congressional Democrats in particular, if they want to talk about affordability, they ought to look in the mirror. We are fixing what they're broken. We're proud to do it. It's the job that we were elected to do. But I think 2026 is going to be the year where this economy really takes off.
And that's their best way of holding both chambers. It's going to be in the economy, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that, there's a lot of optimism coming from the administration when they look in their crystal ball to Q1 and Q2. You listen to Treasury Secretary Bessent, you listen to the vice president, you listen to the president. They feel like everything's going to click. They just need it to do that. And Byron York, in one sense, is right that the president can't say things are great if people don't feel it, but they're betting and they put a big bet that people are going to feel it.
I guess it's all about their action plan and see where we go from here. Your thought about the president going out on the road again as if he's on the ballot, but it's starting right away as early as next week.
Well, I think it's smart. It's smart because you look at those polls, he's upside down in a lot of different perceptions around the country. Now, polls are polls, and you can argue about who are you asking, et cetera, and is that really an accurate picture? It's a snapshot, and all the polls are tracking roughly the same way, and they have their own internal polls that show them. So it's a necessity that the American people think he's focusing on them and domestic issues, even though he can still walk and chew gum at the same time.
I understand that. So Brett, do you want to name your panel yet, or do you want to call them first?
I'm going to call them. I'm going to give them a shot. we haven't named the panel yet.
You have not.
But Brigham will be right now. Not yet.
All right. Brett Baer, have a fantastic weekend. Enjoy the draw today at 11:30.
Who's going to win? Who's going to win the draw?
Well, I mean, you got all these groups that are going to be set up. And the thing that I love about it is everybody knows the NCAA tournament and the number one seeds and number two seeds. So think about that. Now, for the first time since we're hosting, we're going to be treated like a top seed, which means there will be lesser teams, theoretically, than us in our group. You follow me? So as if we're Duke.
Yeah.
As if Duke didn't have to play a regular season. They just said, well, you're Duke, put them up there. So as a host city, we'll get that. We have to get out of our group into the knockout round, which will be quarterfinals. The furthest we ever got was quarterfinals, lost 1-0 to Germany. If America wants to make their legacy and make soccer a super sport, our country has to get to the finals. And I believe this is the most international players we've ever had. We've got eight. If they, you know, all eight make the roster. And we are, this is best America has played in quite some time. So I am optimistic we can do something. So that's
but
my
it
breakdown.
Is important what we draw in our group.
Totally. It's exactly. I mean, people can understand this. You could have two teams in your group. They're, evidently, there's every year there's a group of death where they put four teams in a group and they're all fantastic. You want to avoid the group of death. Only the first two go forward.
Usually you do.
Right.
Usually you want to avoid the group of
Hence
death.
Hence the name.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So, Brett, I'm trying to help you. I want you to go. I know you go to the bars on Friday night, carouse with the guys. So I want you to feel competent out there.
All right. I appreciate it. I'm going to take that and use that in my conversations.
And carouse. Thanks so much, Brett.
All right.
I appreciate it. Always love when Brett Baer joins us. He's going to see his show tonight at 6 p.m. Gerard Baker at the bottom of the hour, Wall Street Journal. We'll talk more about the affordability from the X's and O's standpoint. You are listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete, not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Lawrence, he is in such an effing bubble that he doesn't even know what average people go through. He's a billionaire. He doesn't worry about paying for groceries. I don't know if he's ever been in a grocery store.
Our country is far too expensive. Donald Trump and Republicans promised to lower costs on day one. Costs haven't gone down. Costs have gone up across the board.
It's insane that you destroy the economy, flood it with money, mandate a vaccine during the pandemic, vilify people that don't, fire the military, put a rescue package we don't need, an Inflation Reduction Act that was deceptive, flood everything with money, watch inflation spike, lose an election, and you say, well, this other guy spends too much and we can't control inflation. But the president actually made it tougher for himself when he said he'd do it on day one. It's impossible. You can't turn around a battleship immediately. It's not a matter of putting in reverse. To go around and go across the ocean, you got to turn it around and then get it going. They're in the process of turning it around, and I think by February you're going to see it really get going. And if it doesn't go, you can't say, well, the other guy screwed up the economy. I understand that. But I mean, for Hakeem Jeffries not to do anything and say the president hasn't turned anything around is crazy. It reminds me of what Stephen A. Smith said last night, Cut 15.
What I'm saying is that during the campaign, were you doing what it takes to win? You had too many people going after him for stuff that wasn't going to stick. It wasn't going to influence his voters. So what I would say to you, Whoopi, and what I would say to anybody that doesn't want J.D. Vance or Marco Rubio or somebody like that to succeed him, focus on what's going to win.
Right. And if you might say affordability is what you think is going to win. All right. But I love a follow-up question to Chuck Schumer, who loves to curse these days, and Hakeem Jeffries. What are you doing? Well, we're going to not give tax cuts to billionaires. Listen, the tax cuts were already in place. It was just a matter of making them permanent. And you're talking about 1.5%. Well, what else would you do? Well, I would reconfigure trade deals. Well, he's already doing that. What else would you do? You'd spend money. That's what they want to do. We want to get money to people. Well, where do you get that money when you're $37 trillion in debt? How do you plan on growing the economy? I mean, the case in point and the best thing to ever happen to Trump for his midterm fortunes, I believe, is Oram Amdami. He says he's going to make everything affordable again. There's nothing about what he wants to do that will make anything affordable. His own grocery stores, freezing rents, not going to work. Allowing homeless encampments to stay in the streets, make things more dangerous. All Trump has to do, as well as other Republicans, and say, look, I could tell you what we're doing about bringing manufacturing back here. I could show you the data centers that are now taking root. I could show you the trade deals that are helping the farmers almost immediately. I could tell you how the defense manufacturers are beginning to really surge stock prices on down. I could show you what the stock market's been doing. And that's what the administration can point to. For the Democrats, you're going to keep saying stuff that I don't think is going to stick, because the follow-up question of what you would do is their epic fail. I got so much more to talk about. Gerard Baker next on the Wall Street Journal. Stick around. With the holidays coming, that means more gift buying and more deliveries to the front door. It made me think about how I should upgrade my security to keep away the porch pirates and keep my delivery safe. I went with SimpliSafe because it's proactive. Traditional systems react after a break-in. SimpliSafe can help stop a crime before it starts. That's because SimpliSafe keeps your home safe with a double layer of defense. First, you got cameras detecting potential threats, and then live agents confront them while they're still on the outside of your home before they have a chance to do any damage, telling them they're on camera and telling them the police will be dispatched if they do not leave. That's right, if they don't leave. That's why I trust SimpliSafe at my place to help protect my family, keep an eye on the dogs, and watch those deliveries, because real security stops crime before it starts. Right now is such a good time to get SimpliSafe. This month only, get 50% off any new system. Go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Again, that's simplysafe.com/Brian. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think 2026 is going to be a great year. The president set the table. He's done peace deals, trade deals, tax deals. And the economic policy is really a three-legged stool. In Trump 1.0, we had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So we had tax, but this time it's also deregulation, and the amount of regulation coming off the books is just astounding. In the U.S., that we've gotten out of the ability to make things and to do things in a productive way. And then the third part is trade, and these trade deals, they are bringing in the trillions of dollars and opening up markets for U.S. companies, bringing manufacturing back to the U.S.
That is the Secretary of Treasury. And this is the game plan. You know, these are the things they're doing. It's going to launch. It's going to affect massive things. Now, one thing is pretty clear. He's done already. Taking certain products in our grocery stores down and doing other things on global trade to bring the rest. And number two, he's bringing down the price of gas. It's now under $3, first time in 4.5 years. So that's significant. If you can get diesel down, which has some, I guess, environmental sulfur that they have to put in there, that they got to contain the sulfur. So it's allowing diesel prices to be higher. Why does that matter? Because that's what trucks run on. They're delivering the food. They're still paying high prices. They got to factor it in somewhere. So everyone eats it, including the customer, in theory. So that's, if you can get diesel down, that'll be the last step. And then suddenly things will be inching down. You'll hit people with how they feel, and then you'll hit them with some numbers to back up what you think. But the economy is going to matter the most, both talking about affordability, but one has credibility when it comes to it. And the other word, as far as I know, I'm open to it. Tell me their plan for bringing prices down. So Jim Farley was on with us on Fox and Friends for Ford Motor Company, the CEO. And he's very happy because in the car business, they're taking down the CAFE standards. Out of nowhere, in order to destroy the gas car industry, the Biden administration decided to make the CAFE standards. You got to get 50 miles to the gallon by 2030. It's impossible. They were saying scientifically to get a combustion engine that on an F-150 or an SUV with 50 miles to the gallon, it's not going to work. So Trump came in and says, we're knocking it down to 34. So immediately that helps the price. Immediately that helps the company. Immediately it helps the stock. But ultimately, people are going to walk around and say, I got to buy a car. I got to buy groceries. I'm thinking about getting a house. I want to put an extension on. Is it possible? And then who's president? Gerard Baker joins us now from the Wall Street Journal. Gerard, both sides agree on something. Affordability is going to be the key in the midterms. Who's got the better plan?
Look, I think the problem right now, Brian, is we've had these big price increases over the last 5 years, and they come on top of a period when Americans have got used to basically prices being flat, right? So we had this huge surge in inflation under Biden. Prices went up, you know, by basically 25% in the 4 years under Joe Biden. The rate of inflation, that is, you know, the rate at which prices go up year over year, has actually declined, but those prices are still way higher. So people are just not happy with the way things are right now in terms of total, you know, the prices they've got to pay for things, because they see them as being much higher than they were 5 years ago. It's not a good situation for anybody, for any governing party to be in, because people are basically dissatisfied with the level of prices. Even if the rate of price increases is coming down.
So almost everything that Trump is trying to do is to juice the economy. Unlike the previous administration, they were trying to fix the climate. And I guess give unions more of a stake in just about everything possible. So some of the Trump things that he has in place, you know, the tax cuts are now permanent and predictable. Some of the tax breaks and the refunds are going to be higher than usual because of everything you can write off, including manufacturing. Do you think people, from what you read and what you understand, do you think people start to feel it in the winter and spring?
Yeah, I think people people are not going to be content until they actually see prices stabilizing. Prices are not going to come down, Brian. I mean, that's you know, generally speaking, over a long period of time, prices don't come down. That's been the history of inflation in this country. But they do want to see a stabilization of prices, and we haven't seen that right now. Look, if we get the key thing also is if we get strong growth, if we get growth that actually gives people higher returns in terms of their earnings, in terms of their, you know, what they, you know, the actual real spending power they have, then I think concerns about prices will increase. But until prices stabilize, I think there is going to, and you know, and that's, by the way, that's not just things like grocery prices. It's obviously things like health insurance, you know, the price of housing, all of those things. They are, you know, they continue to make Americans feel uncomfortable with the cost of living. So if we get some stabilization in the next year, I think people will feel better about it. But until then, I don't see voter discontent significantly changing.
So interesting, because Fox did a poll, and they always tend to be negative to Trump. I'm not sure why. But Fox News poll, the condition of the economy, only 25% say excellent, 76% say fair. Fox News poll, economic conditions, the nation, 25% say economic conditions are positive, 76% say negative. They ask personally, how do you feel? 40% positive, 60% negative. And lastly, the majority of Americans say the cost of goods is up. 85% say it's up. 78% say utilities are up. 67% say healthcare is up. 66% say housing is up. And 54% say is gas is up, which it's not, by the way, around the country.
Yeah.
So there's a perception problem. How much can you build in with messaging, and how much just will move as a message?
I don't think you could do a lot with messaging. And I think that sort of denying that there's a problem, saying affordability is a con job, which the president's doing, is probably not the right way to go right now. It's exactly the problem that Biden, you know, that Biden got himself into by sort of denying that there was actually a problem. So I think messaging can only take you so far. I think, look, we're going to have to see if the rate of inflation is actually not that much higher than it has been historically, right? Prices are rising maybe by about 3% a year. The problem is that it comes on top of these huge price increases we've seen over the last 5 years. And the onus, the burden on this administration is actually probably greater than it would normally be, not because of any policies that Trump is following, but because of the situation that we've had over the last 5 years. And I think they've got to do messaging is not really going to solve the problem. They've actually got to find, you know, and this is partly the Federal Reserve. It's partly the broader, you know, global economic conditions we live in. Until a rate of price increases starts to stabilize, I don't think people are going to feel good about the cost of living.
How about wages going up?
that will help. I mean, clearly, and we're starting to see that to some extent. You know, part of this, a lot of this comes down to productivity, Brian. If you get productivity increases, and we are seeing that thanks in part to AI and some other technological advances, then productivity will increase. The amount of return that goes to workers, that is, you know, in terms of wages, that will increase. So that will help. But again, I still think the overriding pressure is actually on reducing the sense that the cost of living for most people is just out of reach right now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're going to see what happens as the president tries to move things forward. When it comes to utility costs, it's really state run. But when we build these data centers in these states, on surface it looks good. But are the data centers, from what you know, Jerry Baker, are they upping the price of utilities for everybody in that state or that city?
No. So what they're doing is obviously they're providing jobs, they're providing opportunities for people, and that's a good thing. And we're going to see more of that. I think there are going to be many, many more jobs created, thanks to AI investment and things like that. Even though those jobs will replace some jobs that we've been used to, that the investment should actually have the effects of lowering prices. It should make the economy more productive. It should make things less expensive. So that is, you know, that's something that, and the more investment we can get here, Brian, the more we can encourage investment, as the president is obviously trying to do, the better for the economy. That will create more jobs. It will actually create more supply. And in the end, this is what this is about. It's actually creating supply. And actually, when you create more supply, and then the cost of the goods that you're producing and the services you're producing should start to decline.
We'll see what happens on the economic message. How effective will it be when the president starts going out beginning next week? I mean, this is really his last hurrah. I mean, he might help the Republican candidate, likely to be J.D. Vance, but this is it. He is technically on the ballot because his whole agenda is on the ballot. Do you think that he could be counted on to deliver? Can he deliver some momentum for people voting for his party and not him?
Of course he can. Look, everything we've seen about Donald Trump is that when he's on the ballot, when he is out there as a candidate, as the leading political figure in the country, he gets a lot of support. People like him. They understand that he speaks to them, and he speaks in a language that they identify with. So I think, the more he can do that, the better. I think the problem for Republicans is when he's gone, what is the party's message? What does it stand for? Is it still able to articulate the ideas that Donald Trump has been so effective at articulating? Is it a party that stands for working people? I mean, I do think, Brian, that one of the great political skills of Donald Trump is that he's been able to make the Republican Party a party that represents working people of all backgrounds, of all ethnicities, all parts of the country. Because he speaks their language, whether it's on immigration, whether it's on things like defense and America's role in the world. He's been very good at that. I think the more he gets out and makes the case, the better it will be for Republicans. But obviously, in 3 years' time, they'll be gone, and the Republicans have got to find somebody else.
You know, it's going to be interesting because the one thing Republicans will run on is the craziness that we saw in the 7th District in Nashville. You know, the woman that doesn't like her own city, a woman that is protesting ICE on camera, who wants to say it's okay to burn down police stations, will not commit to not defunding the police, I mean, who think men can have babies. Yet all the idiocy wrapped up in one candidate. Right. She lost by 9.5, which many people think wasn't enough. Do you think Republicans can be effective running on we haven't lost our minds like they have?
Yeah, absolutely, Brian. I mean, look, I think, again, one of the reasons people voted for Donald Trump last year was because, you know, he spoke common sense and he represented normality. Right. Like one of the most effective campaigns he ran. The campaign ad he ran last year where the ad talked about Kamala Harris supporting people who got taxpayer funds to prisoners, you know, felons who got taxpayer funds to undergo, you know, gender transition surgery. And he said that, you know, remember the famous tagline of that, which is that she's for they, them, President Trump is for you. That is an incredibly powerful message. The Democrats, you're right, have basically lost their minds on these issues over the last 5 years. And I did think that Daphne Bain, her campaign, was a reminder of how far out of the mainstream most of the Democrats have got. So, yeah, that's a big – I think that remains a big political advantage.
And, Jerry, finally, I'm talking about Jerry Baker of the Wall Street Journal. Who has a harder job? The Republicans with their extreme right, pro-Russia, pro-anti-Israel message, who are for – against any – Venezuelan operation, or are you think the Democrats have a harder time with their socialist wing? Who's going to? What party's going to have a harder time uniting?
Oh, I think if the Democrats continue on that extreme left, that radical woke, you know, far left political agenda, I think they're still way beyond out of the mainstream of where most Americans want to be. You know, we've done this for 20 years, Brian. We went in that direction. The country, you know, under the Democrats, the country kind of went in a direction most people didn't want to go in. There are still plenty of evidence that's where the Democrats are, that they still believe in that stuff. And so I think that, you know, if Republicans can focus, if Republicans can focus on the things that matter to Americans, which is things like affordability and rising prices and, you know, immigration, getting control of our borders, getting control of our country's defense and security, they are much more likely to be in touch with where ordinary Americans are than this far left progressive Democratic Party.
And lastly, Jerry, when you talk about the immigration issue here, the president coming out bluntly saying Somalis don't help us, we're going to freeze all immigration from third world countries, 20 strong. And he's also looking at his State Department to tell Europe to do essentially the same thing. You see the problems they're having with immigration in UK, in the UK and in Germany and in Denmark and other places, France especially. Do you think that they understand that their national identity is jeopardized right now?
They've come belatedly to recognize it, Brian. The Europeans have basically been committing suicide for a very long period of time. They've been doing it on immigration, basically allowing their countries to be completely, their civilization to be completely overrun, actually denying the legacy of their civilization and denying, you know, the idea that their civilizations are good things. They've actually basically sort of surrendered to alternative civilizations. So they've been doing that for a long time. They've been doing it on things like the climate craziness, the extremism, on the environmentalism. They've basically been saying, we don't really believe, you know, our societies are actually worth preserving. Now, the people, the leaders have done that for a long time. The people are starting to revolt against that. They're starting to elect parties that actually do want to preserve their civilization, that do believe in their society, that do believe that they're fundamentally, you know, that Western civilization is worth preserving. And that's the fight that Europe's in right now. You're seeing these so-called populist parties that are campaigning for that against the establishment. And I think the Europeans are, you know, again, it's very, very late. It's very late in the day. Mm. They've lost a lot of ground. Immigration has been out of control in Europe. But I think we're going to see, and, you know, some of them are taking their lead from Donald Trump, to be honest with you. We're going to see a change in Europe. They are going to revolt against it. And I think that, you know, we'll see in the next 5 years whether or not they're successful.
Jerry Baker, thanks so much. Appreciate it. We come back. We'll be right with you. Phone calls right around the bend. Don't move. Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Well, I'm super, super excited. Americans, but also, I have to say, public from all over the world. We have 1 billion people watching this draw. The final draw, where everyone is happy because everyone qualified. The final draw will determine the match schedule. So after the draw, we'll know who plays where and what is the path to glory to determine who will be the world champion on the 19th of July. But it will be massive, and the draw tomorrow will be absolutely stunning. A big, big show. We are in America. We have to make a show, right?
That is true, and it is America. There's going to be a show, and it's going to start at 11:45 Eastern time in the morning. Obviously, it's going to go on for a couple of hours. As Lexi Lawless told us on this air, don't worry about when the draw happens. Just listen and watch the whole time. But you need to know the groups, because there'll be groups of four, 144 games, and in those groups, you're guaranteed three games. In those three games, your goal is to win the division. Number two is to come in second. They advance. And then there's a wild card for the best third-place team. But, of course, if you're the best third-place team, that means you got to play the best number one seed with the highest points to get through. So where you place is going to be hard. If you have the group of death and you're with four great teams, every game is going to be a challenge. You might be the best team, but walk out with three ties. End up as a wild card team. And then you really got to fight your way through the teeth of Argentina and Spain. I just think the whole thing is going to be how well the U.S. does. I know financially it's going to be great, but for U.S. soccer to be great, the U.S. men's team's got to get to the final.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, everybody, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, right? Two blocks from the tree, which is a great part of the city. I understand it. But if you're on foot, you love it. But if you want to drive, you can't. You had to see yesterday these cops in the middle of the street trying to get it through people's heads that you cannot yell your way through traffic, telling people not to block traffic. I've never seen such exasperation. So, again, I'm glad it's Christmas season. I'm glad for the city that they got people here. I'm happy that tradition continues with the 75-foot spruce. But if you're going to drive in the city, do not expect to get anywhere remotely quick. Trey Gowdy is standing by. I know that every day he's not in the city, he's happy. And Ben Shapiro at the bottom of the hour, co-founder of the Daily Wire, you know what's going on there. And a quick announcement, we know too, big World Cup day. In about an hour, you're going to see the beginning of World Cup draw coverage. And this is so much different than 94 when nobody knew what soccer was and kind of rooted against it when we had it. I really get the sense the general sports fan, not just soccer fans. Soccer fans will always be there. The general sports fan is pumped up about it. And I love it. I love that Fox has it. So before we get to Trey, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
You commit crimes, you go to jail. Doesn't matter what your race is, what your ethnicity, religion. But demonizing the entire group of people by their race and their ethnicity is something I was hoping we'd never have to see.
Well, why don't you straighten out your own state first? Bigger than anyone thought. The Minnesota billionaire social services scam is spiraling in the wrong direction for Governor Waltz, for the Attorney General, and for Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who now has one of her staffers implicated in it, and a restaurant owner who hosts her events right in the middle of it. We have that story that most of the media is ignoring.
Number two.
This issue raises what really is a classic in the literature about use of force. And there's extensive discussion by lawyers, thoughtful people at the time about what morality requires you to do in wartime. That kind of debate is what we need to be having now. And instead, it's beginning to be the usual sharp disagreement between Republicans and Democrats.
Drug boat bombing explained off the coast of Venezuela, as Dems foolishly, in my opinion, just won't let it go. We bring you the post-game briefing that should have answered all the questions.
Number one.
Now, Trump's economic plans has always been very, very simple. Cut taxes, cut regulation, and make energy cheaper. The one thing he can't do on this tour is tell people things are great for them when they're not.
That is true, and he's overstating it when he says it's a hoax. What he's saying is the Democrats claiming that his administration made things unaffordable, that's the hoax, but he's got to clarify that, which I think he's going to do. Game plans hatched for Dems and Republicans. The bud word affordability is embraced by both sides. The country is unaffordable to agree by, but guess who caused it? Democrats and the GOP in a race to fix it. Like it or not, fair or unfair, it's on their report card. And a guy who knows that, fair and unfair, He's a black and white guy. Trey Gowdy, former chairman of House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, host of Sunday Night in America with Trey Gowdy. I'm honored to follow him at 10 o'clock on Sundays. He begins at 9. Author of The Color of Death, which is a novel and a great Christmas gift. Trey, welcome back.
Hey, Brian, I am nothing but the setup man for the closer on Sunday nights. Brian, kill me.
No, you are the number one ratings on Sundays. So listen, I got to bring you to the affordability. You know life isn't fair, and you know what I said is probably true, that Democrats are more responsible for the prices, obviously, than Republicans, but they're going to get blamed. If I gave you that huddle and I said, you're the quarterback, Trey, fix it, walk into that huddle and tell me what you would tell the other Republicans.
Let people know that you feel their pain, because at a certain point, you know, we're past who's to blame for it. We just know that we're hurting. So I would tell them, look, you got to deliver the message, but how you communicate matters. And it really does impact people when you listen and say, I feel your pain. I mean, I run into young people all the time, Brian, and they're worried about the cost of health insurance. It's not a political issue to them. It's a bottom line issue. So I don't want to say the facade of empathy, because it's not a facade. I think many Republicans, including the president, very much understand that people are experiencing pain. Let them know that you hear them. Let them know that you feel it, and then tell them what your plan is. People, look, Americans are not known for their patience. I think in April, when the tax bill comes due, they'll have a renewed appreciation for what Republicans have done. We just have never been great at communicating empathy and sympathy. And that's what I would tell the folks. Number one, quit fighting with one another in the House, because you look like idiots. Number two, let people know you feel their pain and you have a plan to fix it.
I've never seen such fighting on any party or any chamber. Right now, Nancy Mace is threatening to quit. So Elise Stefanik is going after the speaker, saying the most horrible things about his ability to lead, which I don't think are accurate, but I'm a big fan of hers. Then you have a situation where the party can't even get together on an agenda. So everyone's fighting with everyone. And on the Senate side, Rand Paul is in a world of his own. It seems to be siding everything on the Epstein files to now the Venezuela operation, siding with Democrats. Now, I know you can't have everybody march to the same hymn sheet, but sing to the same hymn sheet, I guess the phrase goes. But I've never seen such bickering. This is the attitude that ousted Kevin McCarthy.
It is, and that is not lost on me. Look, Elise and Mike are both very, very good friends of mine. I love them both. You know, my advice is you have one another's cell phone numbers. I mean, do not fight this out on the front pages of Politico or the New York Times. And I would say, look, I was in the House. I was very frustrated by the fact that the Senate has to get 60 votes. But there are also days I was glad they had to get 60 votes because we were in the minority in the Senate. So this world of communicating via X or social media, you can't do that if your teammates. We have the gift of governance, Brian. Think about this. You have the House, the Senate, and the White House. You may not have that in 2 years. You likely will not have it. What are you doing with the gift that you currently have? And how would you like to go home and explain to people, hey, this is what we've done with the gift of governance that you gave us? I mean, what do we have to show for the last couple of months?
No, I hear you. So I want to pivot, if I can, to Venezuela and going after those boats. And I looked this up as soon as this became a story. How many times did Barack Obama, while you were in the House, drone terrorists, suspected terrorists? He didn't want to put anybody in Gitmo, so he just killed them where they were, including an American.
Right.
And a lot of times he blew up weddings, and other times he killed innocent civilians. If you're a terrorist with your family, everyone's dying. We accepted that for 8 years. Now we have these drug boats where they're being eyed, and I think they're being taken out. Not sure, but I believe they're being taken out by drones. And now people are saying, well, if you don't hit them once, you have to go back and save them. You can't hit them again. You've got a great legal mind. Where did that come from?
Every fact matters, Brian, and that's what sometimes is lost in politics. So every fact matters. the survivors, what were they doing? Were they in communication with other people? Were they trying to secure what was left of the drugs that was not knocked out by the initial strike? I mean, do we know all of those answers? I mean, we live in this world where we want to be first, more so than we want to be accurate. And that is the opposite of the way court works. So here's what I do know. Two of the most principled colleagues that I ever served with are Marco Rubio and John Lee Ratcliffe. Two of the most principled people. Forget about politics. Two of the most principled people I know. So I know that you work closely with Pete. I don't know Pete as well, but I know those two guys. And you know, John's got a daughter serving in the military. And I'm sorry if I outed that, if that's a family secret, but this is personal with them. So the notion that they would be part of some war crime, look, you got to be really careful when you throw that around. And if you don't have all the facts, and guess what? I bet they don't. I bet they don't have all the facts. It used to be that the military was above politics. The politics kind of ended when it dealt with military. I mean, do we know how many people were killed with the Iranian nuclear strikes? I mean, do we? I don't know. You might know.
No.
But people view that as successful. So what's different off the coast of Venezuela? Why is, I mean, look, we may be doing drone strikes that you and I have no idea what's going on with terrorist groups in the Middle East. I mean, are we okay with that? I need to know all the facts. Look, I Americans do treat their enemies better than their enemies treat them. That is a given. And we do try to abide by international treaties, even when those governing bodies aren't fair to us. I mean, for Pete's sake, there's an arrest warrant out for Benjamin Netanyahu. So how seriously can you take some of these groups? Having said that, when I don't have all the facts, I try not to render a verdict.
Right. And then when they go and get briefed and they're all convinced and they go out to the cameras and say something different. Dave Ignatius, a clear thinking guy, usually on MSNBC from The Washington Post. But man, does he have international connections and a knowledge of war. Cut 40.
We have Congressman Jim Himes, the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, say it's one of the most troubling things he's ever said. And his counterpart, the Republican, Lankford, saying it was highly professional. Senator Tom Cotton, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, saying it was righteous. So we're back to the same kind of partisan divide, I want to say partisan mess. And that's really unfortunate because this issue raises what really is a classic in the literature about use of force. During World War II, you'd have German submarines sinking shipping, and the question was, what do you do about the survivors? Do you go rescue them? Do you go rescue them if you're at risk? And there's extensive discussion by lawyers, thoughtful people at the time, about what morality requires you to do in wartime. That kind of debate is what we need to be having now, and instead, it's beginning to be the usual sharp disagreement between Republicans and Democrats, almost reflexive. And if this moment is wasted for a real discussion, we'll all be the worse for it.
And I could just interject. I would not say that these drug boats are like supply chain ships. You know, those ships in World War II, those merchant ships were carrying goods, where the supply, these other boats are have one thing, go as fast as you can to the closest Caribbean island full of drugs. No one denies they're drug ships. But having said that, this is the way you should be approaching this.
Yeah, and I would also add the number one cause of death among young Americans, not guns and not car accidents, it is fentanyl. So you can certainly argue that it is self-defense.
Yeah.
This is what gives me pause. Jim Himes was among the more reasonable people that I served on the House Intel Committee with. James Lankford is one of the best people you will ever meet in life. If I could get the two of them together, I would sit them down together and say, all right, tell me what you're seeing. But we don't do that anymore, Brian. We go run to our respective television cameras. I will give credit to Himes. He's willing to go on Fox. I assume James is willing to go on enemy territory, too. But I'd love to have them both in the room or on your show.
Right.
Or on your show, One Nation, and say, okay, you guys are both decent people. How do y'all see this differently?
Well, put it this way. Jim Himes said they were shipwrecked. What are they, Gil? You know, is this a skipper in Marianne?
I agree with his phraseology.
Yes.
That is not a shipwreck, Jim.
You kidding me?
But I will say this. Jim Himes, in an open committee, I told him that something Democrats were doing was unfair, and he did something I've never seen a Democrat do other than Peter Welch. In an open hearing, he said, "You're right. What we just said was unfair." So that is the Jim Himes I served with. Now, when you get elevated, when you're in a leadership position, things change, Brian. People expect you. You know, Jim Himes is more likely to get a primary from the left than he is to be beat in a general election. So I don't know how much of this is politics. I don't know how much of it is, you know, reflexively we have to criticize the other side.
Right.
I just, when it comes to war, I mean, war crimes is a really serious accusation, like treason. You don't hear me accuse people of treason, Brian, because you can get put to death for that. We got to be careful how we phrase things. John Lee Ratcliffe is not going to commit a war crime, period, full stop.
I tell you, everyone sounds so impressive when you use their middle name. I should have, years ago, dedicated myself to my middle name. I would sound more impressive. You keep using his middle name, and I even like him more. So do you know who's on your show Sunday?
I do. We got Trish McLaughlin. We got some members of the House and Senate. I'm trying to get somebody to explain the Lane Kiffin thing to me. If I could, I don't have your contacts in the sports world. I don't get leaving a playoff team, Brian. I don't get that. So whoever you doesn't make the cut for your roster is usually who I get on my show.
Oh, yes.
But yes, I've been working on it this morning. It's going to be a good lead-in for One Nation with Brian Kilmeade.
It always is. It's always fantastic. And it's always deep thoughts at the end or questions from the people to Trey Gowdy at the end, which is fantastic.
I love.
Right. And by the way, I've never been more jealous of not to be in South Carolina where you do your show than now, because in December, it feels like mid-February. We had Ron DeSantis on the couch today. He couldn't even recover from it because it's like in 20 degrees. So I'm jealous of your climate.
I got to go turn the air conditioning on, Brian. I'm actually a little warm right now. But I will say this. Why don't you move down here? We would love to have you down here.
Listen, I've talked to your people. They say visit but promise to leave. That is the message in South Carolina. You're tired of the Yankees coming down, I heard.
We want yeah, but you're a good Yankee.
Oh,
we
okay.
want you down here.
I'm the Jeter of Yankee tourists.
We would love to have you down here.
All right, Trey, I'm going to take that to the bank and into the Chamber of Commerce, and I might make my move.
Sir.
I'm going to watch 9 o'clock Eastern time, Sunday night. Trey Gowdy, thanks so much.
God bless you, Brian. Take care.
All right, stay within yourself, Trey. Back in a moment.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I think one of the problems here is actually the success that Donald Trump had in his first term. A lot of people thought that reelecting him would automatically lead to an economic turnaround. And I don't think that they actually had built into their heads how bad the Biden economy was. And because of that, I think there's going to be a lot of work that needs to be done on the side of Republicans in order to encourage people and to, frankly, message against what they're going to get hit with.
And that's Ben Domenech, and he's right. You know, Barack Obama gave the president a better economy than Joe Biden. And the problem is, too, is, you know, look, President Trump was spending a lot of money during the pandemic. We remember that. Remember that he requested money and then Congress added more money on top of it? You know, he had his own stimulus package in December before he left, or it might have been November. So he loses the election. They got a stimulus. And Democratic-controlled Congress put more money on top, the House anyway. So they were spending. But when Joe Biden decides to do the rescue package and make it all his agenda items, wasn't really to fuel the economy. Yeah, there was some stuff for PPE and things like that, pharmaceuticals, but it was an agenda thing. And you had Larry Summers, now defamed, say, this is a huge mistake. This is going to fuel inflation. And then the next year they do the Inflation Reduction Act, which was not, and they kind of laughed about it. So you have all that money in. Now, I know you were coming out of a pandemic, but it was just handled extremely poorly by people who don't understand fiscal responsibility. And that's not what Democrats are ever known for. So the president wants to get the you know, with the tariffs, wants to use that to get the deficit down. I got it. Is doing all these things to prime the pump. But things are harder because we're coming out of the pandemic and because you're replacing a guy that was being run by the extreme left. He made a deal with Bernie Sanders to run his state like a socialist state.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We go one way or the other, and we're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country. Ilhan Omar is garbage. She's garbage. Her friends are garbage. These aren't people that work. These aren't people that say, let's go, come on, let's make this place great. These are people that do nothing but complain. They complain. And from where they came from, they got nothing.
So he's talking about Somalia, and he's talking about the Somali community inside Minneapolis, mostly Minnesota. It's the largest one of the country. And we also know this huge burgeoning scandal where they've been bilking. Most of them are Somalis. I mean, 79 of the 84 indictments are Somalis. 52 of the convictions, almost all are Somalis. And it looks systematic. And the money might, in fact, be going back to Somalia to Al-Shabaab, their Al-Qaeda affiliate. So if that, indeed, that's a Chris Rufo connection that he talked about last week, that is being pursued now by the Treasury Department. And the president is fed up. She's fed up with people like Ilhan Omar who do nothing but complain or raise kids that have anti-Semitic, take part in anti-Semitic protests at Columbia, who just whine about this country instead of trying to make it better. And by the way, one of her staffers is indicted, and a restaurant that she has an affiliation with is right in the middle of it, stealing tens of millions of dollars. So this is going to get a lot bigger. But is the president language helpful? His directness. Let's bring in Ben Shapiro, Daily Wire co-founder, host of The Ben Shapiro Show, number one New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is Lions and Scavengers, The True Story of America. Hey, Ben, welcome. Your thoughts about the president's approach and now banning travel, immigration from, I think, 19 to 20 countries.
I mean, on policy, there's no question he's correct. I mean, the fact is that we cannot vet people who are coming in from countries that effectively have no government. And not only do they have no government, what government they do have is very often complicit in actual terrorism, especially when you're talking about a place like Somalia, where something like 35% of its entire economy is remittances from the United States, which is totally insane. And so what the president is doing by saying we can't have mass migration from areas where people don't hold anything in common with us, generally hate American values, have no love for the American Constitution. I don't even see what's remotely controversial about that part of it. Obviously, the president uses the president's language. And anybody who's shocked at President Trump's language after a decade of President Trump, I think, I mean, get over it. Like, honestly, we're now 10 years into this. And on the list of insults, this comes up very short.
So, you know, this thing's going to get big. You know, Keith Ellison, who's just was a terrible congressman and a horrible attorney general, but the people of Minneapolis seem to like him, is defending Governor Walz's responses to the fraud that's going to be over $1 billion. And with the stuff they, the programs they took from autistic programs, from poor people, from these food programs, some of which Ilhan Omar sponsored and got federal funding for. So this is going to be really big. Where do you think this goes as the federal government gets involved?
Well, I mean, obviously, the investigations are probably going to grow from here. My guess is that's only the beginning. I think that probably there's more there than they've even uncovered so far. One of the funnier articles I saw, there was an ABC affiliate that came out this morning talking about the benefits of mass Somali migration into Minnesota and pointing out that the total income of Somali Minnesotans was $500 million last year. Well, I noticed that $500 million as a total income is half of what was built from the federal government just in the cases that have already been uncovered. So if what we're talking about is the great enrichment that has happened due to mass migration, and the best you can come up with is an income that amounts to half of the fraud committed by this small group of Somalis, then I'm not sure exactly what case it is that you're making at this point. Again, this is not to malign every single person who's coming from Somalia, because whenever you have a group of people, I'm sure there are great individuals that exist within a broader spectrum of human beings. And, you know, when the president says garbage, I think, by the way, in that quote, he seems to be talking specifically about Ilhan Omar, who I also agree is a trash human being. I think she has horrible beliefs. I think that she stands for horrible things. And then he says, and her friends, I don't know that he's necessarily referring to every single Somali person in the United States. He may be referring to people who are politically affiliated, or he may be referring to her actual specific friends, some of whom seem to be caught up in the actual fraud welfare scheme here.
Including one of her staffers that's involved. Yes. And one of these restaurant owners who owns a Safari Inn has 35 tables But yet he claims to, he's gotten reimbursed for 18,000 meals. Well, he's got a multi-million dollar mansion. I mean, are we kidding? And guess what?
He's spending $9,000 a month at Nordstrom.
Yeah.
That's a lot of, I hope he dresses well. That's a lot of clothes. $9,000 a month. Whoa.
So Ben, I'm going to add something to this. So if you actually bilk out of this money, there's now a phone call that I understand that the Attorney General Ellison has where some of these people involved in the fraud pledge campaign contributions, which he eventually collects from these people. They also did the threatening, you talk about full circle, of if you come down on me, I'm going to hit you with the racism and bias claims, which backs out these politicians who need the 80,000 member Somali committee or community to vote for them.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, obviously, every politician has to answer to constituents. And so when you have Keith Ellison basically, you know, garnering campaign contributions from many of the same people who are associated with this sort of activity and saying, I'm going to be your guy. I mean, I'm not sure how that isn't a scandal. I think Tim Walz obviously is a scandal. I think Ilhan Omar obviously is a scandal. It's hard to see how fraud perpetrated at this great a scale was unknown by everyone in a position of power, especially people who are extremely close to the communities in question.
Ben, not that you should be surprised. That's why you started the Daily Wire. But they looked at the networks and say how much coverage this has gotten. Zero. You know, I know the nightly news. I mean, zero. How could that not be $1 billion gone from a state like Minnesota? But I want to talk about also what's going on with the anti-Semitism. I spoke at a Jewish conference last night. And the isolation that the Jewish community feels, especially in New York City, is beyond comprehension, especially with the election of this mayor. And there's some studies that are really disturbing. Nearly 4 in 10 of the current GOP, 37%, believe the Holocaust was exaggerated and did not happen as history described. By the way, I met a Holocaust survivor last night, 96 years old. He told me it happened. Who would have thought? Younger men are especially likely to hold this view, 54% of men under 30, 39% of women under 50. Among men over 50, 41% agree, compared with 18% of women over 50. How did that happen? How does this happen, Ben?
Well, I do think that one of the things that poll from Manhattan Institute is really fascinating, because it sort of breaks down traditional GOP and then people who are sort of new GOP voters in 2024. And what it shows is that the traditional GOP is significantly less likely to believe the sort of conspiratorial or anti-Semitic nonsense. A lot of new GOP are more likely to believe it, mainly because they were alienated by the Democratic Party, but not necessarily because they hold traditional sort of conservative views. And it does show that whenever you have an electoral coalition, there are a lot of people inside that electoral coalition, but the coalition is defined by its leadership. Are the leaders willing to say true things? Are the leaders willing to call out actual bad beliefs? Are they willing to call out the purveyors of those actual bad beliefs? Because, listen, no political leader should be expected to condemn every single person who is voting for them. But if the question is, who defines the future of the coalition, who defines the belief system by which the coalition rides together, that really does come down to a question of leadership. And I think that leadership has been in some quarters not present, particularly in the online space. It has been very much not present. And let's be clear that on X and TikTok, this sort of stuff goes viral very, very quickly.
Yes, and maybe disproportionately. We get the theory that maybe too many people think that way. But let's just amp this up. It's very commonplace and it's total truth to say that the Democrats have a huge problem. And they'll admit it with the so-called socialist wing of the party that's growing. Got it. Like that left-wing lunatic who ran in the 7th District of Tennessee. I understand it. And then they got other people that are looked at as moderates, the Spanburgers, the Joe Manchins, who's not in politics anymore. I got it. And Fetterman, to me, seems to speak what I would hope be the future of that party, but he's the minority of that party. That's the fracture we like to dissect. But in your estimation, do the Republicans have a problem with the extreme right that says, you know what, Israel, they're way too over the top. We're way too close to them. Russia, they're just misunderstood. We shouldn't be involved. Venezuela, not our problem. Why are we worried about that? Do you think that divide on the Republican side presents the same quantitative problem as the Democrats have?
So I think that there is a massive quantitative problem on the Republican side. I don't think it's about disagreements over Israel policy or Venezuela policy or even Ukraine policy. I think it has to do with something deeper. And that is, I think there's a wing of the Republican Party that is rejecting the basic promise of meritocracy, which used to be sort of the root of the conservative agenda. The root of the conservative agenda was the idea that we have constitutional checks and balances in order to preserve God-given freedoms that allow us to rise or fall on our own merits. That was basically the promise of the United States. And there is a side of the right that has decided that the meritocracy is actually a lie, and that what we actually need to do is target a so-called globalist elite who are manipulating the system to their own ends. That tends to cross over with conspiratorial views, particularly about Jews, but it tends to cross over with other sort of conspiratorial views in general, which is something you've seen growing inside the Republican Party. That same poll shows that there are a huge number of Republicans who believe in conspiracy theories about 9/11 or even the moon landing. And that sort of thing, I think, again, goes to a grievance-based politics that used to be more foreign to the conservative coalition, but definitely right. has been growing in recent years. I know why it's been growing. I mean, the reason it's been growing is because if the left continues to say for years and years and years that white Christian men are bad, particularly, then there will be a reactionary response to that by saying, okay, we've been victimized. The system has been constructed in order to put us down. But that response shouldn't be to destroy all systems, or that capitalism is bad, or free markets are bad, or freedom of thought is bad, or that America historically is bad. The response should be meritocracy. Unfortunately, very often it isn't. And it's a sort of grievance-based right. politics that looks more left than right.
Well, that I mean, that's a theory, Ben. I mean, that's a deep theory. The other thing is people doing it for clicks. Well, what if I did a show and I interview a World War II historian that says Hitler was misunderstood, that we never really should have got involved, that Winston Churchill was more of a problem. He was just going to take Czechoslovakia and maybe a little of Poland, and that was it. We way overreacted, never should have dropped the bombs on Japan. So what if you have somebody that says building number 7 was an inside job and their name wasn't Rosie O'Donnell, that 9/11 was an inside job? Of course, everybody knew it, and they talk about everybody involved in it. What if that same group said, wait, a man popped out of a pothole cover and shot Charlie Kirk, not somebody from the roof? So I don't know if there's a school of thought there, or if someone's just trying to outdo each other with sensational claims.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's both. It's all of the above. It's definitely a clickbait thing. It's definitely, you know, very viral online. All of that is definitely true. I think there is an ideological aversion to, again, basic American principles with some of these folks that really amounts to a great demoralization, an attempt to demoralize all Americans. Everything you've been told is a lie. Everything about America that you've ever been told is untrue. America itself is rotten to the core, and only I, the conspiracy theorist or the person who's laying out this new vision or no vision, only I am the real spirit guide for you who can illuminate all of the secrets that have been hidden from. That's why your life isn't what you want it to be, is because no one has told you the truth, but I'm here to tell you the truth. Now, the problem, of course, is that it's not the truth, and all of these lies are going to make your life markedly worse. But it's kind of sexy to believe that the reason that your life isn't what you want it to be is because of conspiratorial forces beyond your control. And if only you could see past the curtain, then magically your life would be fixed.
So, I mean, I look at you, your success. You got it. You made your success online. You formed your own company. Everybody knows it. But you don't say anything sensational. These are just your opinions. They're conservative thought. What's in the conservative school of thought? There's always debate. Rush Limbaugh didn't change his delivery or his statements in order to remain number one. He just was consistent. As issues came up, he knew exactly what he was going to dig into, and he quickly knew his opinion. So would Rush Limbaugh recognize the right now?
I think it'd be very difficult for him to recognize at least some segments of the right. I don't want to say it's the entire right, because it isn't. I think a huge percentage of the Trump right doesn't believe a lot of this nonsense. And all the numbers that we're citing, except for some of the young men numbers, are minority numbers. But I will say that, yes, I mean, let's put it this way. Brian, if I went back 10 years and I looked at the stuff that you were saying, it looks exactly the same as the stuff that you're saying now. Nobody has ever asked what happened to Brian Kilmeade, right? Nobody who's looked at the course of my career, I've been writing syndicated columns since I was 17. I'm now 41. Nobody would look at anything that I've said and said, what happened to Ben? How did Ben Shapiro change? But there are an enormous number of quite powerful influencers, and that question is being asked about them all the time. What happened to this person? What changed for this person? And if this person is radically changing their opinion on a dime and seems to be gaining virality for it, you do have to ask, you know, the question about whether they're chasing virality or on what basis they've changed their opinion.
All right, so let me bring it to practical politics. You, Donald Trump. You had your arms wrapped around everybody. You know, a lot of people had thought you agree, a lot of people on Fox, a lot of people who do the podcast. And now all of a sudden, those people are fighting with each other. And you need every single vote to keep the House and the Senate practically. And then you got this 2028 where you have to have a nominee that's going to have to find a way possibly to be all things to all people or just pick a side. What responsibility do the people in power have now on their own party. You could say that for Democrats, but let's just focus on Republicans now.
I think Republicans have tremendous responsibility to define what the party looks like going forward, because if they don't, then
leaders?
I think the people, yes, the leaders, absolutely. I also think that it's not worthwhile fighting yesterday's war, meaning that J.D. Vance's coalition is not going to be identical to Donald Trump's coalition, because it doesn't work that way. Hillary Clinton's coalition was not identical to Barack Obama. She thought it would be, and that's why she lost. And if Republicans continue to think that every single voter who voted for Donald Trump is just going to translate right over, so if you just say nothing, if you just kind of hover across the top of these controversial issues, that you will be able to keep everybody in your warm embrace. Donald Trump is a unique, sui generis figure who's able to encompass multitudes. That is not true of any other Republican in the field, period. End of story. And so, you know, I wish that President Trump would do it himself. But if President Trump won't do it, then I wish other politicians would say, here is what my conservatism looks like. And more importantly, here is what conservatism does not look like. And here is what can't define the party going forward.
Ted Cruz is. I want you to hear Hillary Clinton, because she seems equally dismayed in a way. Listen.
Smart, well-educated young people from our own country, from around the world, where were they getting their information? They were getting their information from social media, particularly TikTok.
And what she was referring to is her Columbia students' anti-Semitic views. And he doesn't understand. They had no perspective on the Israeli-Palestinian disagreements at all. Just 30 seconds, your thoughts on what she just said.
I mean, that's the worst person you know meme is right, right? You know, when Hillary Clinton, broken clock being correct twice a day, that this is the twice a day. I mean, obviously, the social media algorithms are rotting people's minds. And what I've said to people is, you want to know what Americans really think? Get outside, touch some grass, spend less time on TikTok and on X, and actually go to church and talk with your fellow Americans a little bit. You'll find that the nutty beliefs are significantly less prevalent and important than you believe they are.
All right, Ben, hang in there. Ben Shapiro, go get his book for this holiday season, Lions and Scavengers, and check him out on the Daily Wire all the time. Ben, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Appreciate it. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I don't want to hear, but I understand the LGBTQ community is important. I understand that the desolate and disenfranchised is somebody we should always be looking out for. I understand the economy. I understand immigration. I get all of that. Mm-hmm. But the point is, I'm trying to win to make sure that I'm in office and you're not. What is it going to take? The Democrats did not do that last time.
What is the winning issue now?
Affordability and safety.
And safety. Yeah, no doubt about it. But I'd love to hear a Democrat's plan. And, you know, Stephen A. Smith goes on his All Things to All People, but he goes and tells people directly on The View when he's there. But obviously he's the one who points out problems, obvious ones with Kamala Harris and others. And I think he's pretty fair to Trump. And I think that he is not somebody you fit into a category. Personally, I think he leans right, but the guy's a machine. I mean, what he's able to do in his general talk show, his sports talk show, his TV appearances. It's not easy to keep up with sports, all sports. And now he's doing it and keeping up with news. It's pretty impressive. So don't forget, go to BrianKilmeade.com. Get tickets to Fort Myers on Valentine's Day. History, Liberty, and Laughs streamed on Fox Nation, the world's favorite streaming device. And keep it here. And don't forget, Sunday at 10 o'clock is One Nation. We got Doug Burgum with him, Douglas Murray, and so much more. Don't move.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. At the bottom of the hour, Congressman Tom Tiffany will be with us, chairman of Federal Lands Committee, member of the Judiciary. He's actually going to run for governor there, but found out that he has a huge Afghanistan refugee problem right inside Wisconsin and is speaking about it. He's going to be joining us at the bottom of the hour. But with us right now is two guys who put together a book that's number one on the Amazon top 10 list, David Shedd and Andrew Badger, co-authors of The Great Heist, China's epic campaign to steal America's secrets. And I can let out another secret, and that's you'll be on One Nation Sunday night at 10 o'clock. You're right if I give that secret out?
Please give that
out. All right. So, David, let's start with you. What is your, can we just go through, first off, the background in China? When did you first become aware of what they were capable of?
Look, having worked this target during the 1990s, it was pretty clear to me that China was on the ascendancy, especially after 1986 when Deng Xiaoping laid out this plan in order to bring together the sort of controlled capitalism around around the whole issue of the socialist authoritarian government of the Chinese Communist Party. But it really took off, and it was very personal in 2015 when about 22 million files from our security backgrounds were stolen out of the Office of Personnel and Management in May of 2015. Subsequently, 2 years later, Equifax, one of the three largest credit bureaus in the United States, had all their data stolen on 145 million people. And then you have a plethora of cyber attacks on our healthcare system in terms of privacy data. And that it was a wake-up call under Made in China 2025, which was launched by Xi Jinping in 2015. And that's really when I...
Right. And David, I should give people your background. Former director and acting director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, chief of staff for the Director of National Intelligence and National Security Council, senior director, special assistant to the president for intelligence under George W. Bush. Now, Andrew, you're an intel analyst. You spent two decades serving as DIA case officer, strategic risk advisor over at McKinsey. Also, you went to Harvard, but you have to overcome that yourself. I can't help you. All right. So first off, so you two have a real concern as very patriotic Americans. And you feel as though, in a way, I get the sense that America is not fully aware of how bad this is.
Definitely not. This is the largest heist or the theft of secrets in history. And the consequence of that is changed the global balance of power. Now China is dominating these frontier emerging markets, these critical technologies. They're the superpower for innovation right
but
now.
But they didn't earn it. They stole it.
And that's exactly the point of our book, is showing that it's not just because China has a command and control economy. It's not just because they have 1.3 billion people and this massive economy scale. The speed at which China has now become the preeminent technology superpower is because they literally stole these secrets from America, from the West, from all of our years of research and development, one thumb drive in the computer, boom, it's gone. China benefits from it.
Give me an idea, David, of what they've taken.
So, for example, for Tesla in 2019, as Elon Musk was breaking ground in Shanghai for the production and the gigafactory of Teslas that a year later would be producing 300,000 Teslas in China, Mr. Cao, 3 days earlier, is removing $1 billion of source code on the driverless cars that today are part of BYD, the Chinese leading manufacturer of EVs.
Which everyone says is a great car, but you're saying they stole the technology.
For the driverless portion.
For the driverless portion. Yeah, by the way, they stole the technology for the driverless portion from Elon Musk. Does he know it?
Absolutely. And he responded by going to the FBI about the issue, but too little too late. It had already occurred.
And he made the choice to build there.
Exactly. And he cut a deal in which, once it's in Chinese territory, the Chinese government, through again this Ministry of State Security, which is the CIA, FBI, NSA, cybersecurity, and cyber command, is the organization that then pulls that out and carries out the requirements of the Chinese Communist Party.
But they also took our F-35, right?
They certainly did. And with that, then they create the FC-31, which is a near mock-up of the same thing as the F-35, costing Northrop Grumman $100 million to do damage repair on what was taken out of it.
Andrew, don't we realize, I mean, these are people, this is all you do for a living. You're working on the F-35. Aren't you thinking, as much as I want innovation, but I want security with it? Were we not aware of how good they were at it, or did we just leave the back door open?
There's just been this hubris from the United States that China can't compete with us. They're this third-rate agrarian power, and then they're never going to compete with us. So actually, Elon Musk, he was warned, hey, if you set up this factory in China, they're going to steal your code. And he said, don't worry about that. We'll out-compete them. We'll out-innovate them. At the time, Tesla was the superpower in terms of the EV market. Now BYD, China's EV company, has overpassed Tesla. And so this is this shock value that the United States, we've overlooked this threat for many years, and now it's coming home, and now we're seeing the consequences of it. China just held a Victory Day parade in September. We had the leaders of the Axis of Resistance, Russia, North Korea, Iran, and China had
this, and India, by the way.
And India, and this parade down Chang'an Avenue, which is their Times Square, and they were showing off all their latest military equipment, and it's some of the best in the world. Their hypersonic missiles, their stealth technology, their AI-enabled underwater submarines, which could all be used against the American military. All of that can ultimately be traced to, in part, being stolen from the United States. So we have a peer power who's now competing against us, who stole all of our IP and technology, and now they're turning that weapon back towards us.
And the hypersonics, were they taken from us too?
So the hypersonics are absolutely critical. So Los Alamos, which is our lab in New Mexico, this is the frontier of American innovation in terms of our defense technology. You might remember it from the Manhattan Project, where we developed the atomic weapon, and which was stolen by the Soviets. We had an advanced hypersonic program there and a leading scientist who left the Los Alamos hypersonics program, went back to China, and created what Chinese called the Los Alamos Club. He recruited almost 160 people who worked in Los Alamos in some of the most cutting-edge hypersonic technology, and they took all of that back to China. Where are we today? China is now beating us in terms of hypersonic technology. They have nuclear-enabled cruise missiles that are hypersonic, which means they can move super fast, Mach 5, Mach 7, and they can maneuver in the air. So our air defenses can't shoot them down, and now those cruise missiles can reach the United States. So we've seen all of our research and development on this critical technology. The scientists come here, take our R&D, go back to China, and then give it to the Chinese military. And now we're at a strategic disadvantage.
And in May 2021, they tested their hypersonics, and it landed within 25 miles of its target. That is something the United States has not been able to accomplish. So we know that they're ahead of us on the hypersonics program. And just to be clear for your audience, they didn't steal a hypersonics package. They stole the know-how associated with wind tunneling, high-grade materials at high heat and speed and all of that out of Los Alamos, the knowledge. So it wasn't – no one walked off with a hypersonics package.
It's maddening. An excerpt from your book, How China isn't one of the top threats, it is the top threat. You write, no doubt, cheap labor indeed played a role in China's economic surge. So did favorable trade terms and massive infrastructure investments guided by top-down, long-term state planning. But none of these variables explains the speed at which Beijing has closed the gap with America in sensitive sectors. The leap was powered in significant part by what can be described as an epic level of state-sponsored espionage. China's espionage activity against the United States far outweighed that of any other nation, including Russia. And then you say they've made it another step. They said they've embedded in our infrastructure. So they could shut off our water and shut off our power. Do you want to explain that, David?
Well, and yeah. Certainly the
Andrew, yeah.
Andrew, you can take it in either terms way. Of the typhoon attacks.
Exactly. So this great heist, this theft of all of our secrets, has laid the foundation for what we call phase zero. So China has embedded all of these critical malware into our critical infrastructure. Think water systems. Think your electric grid. Think your ports. Think your air tower system. And what they've done is they've identified the weak points in there, embedded these malware, and the moment that a war between the United States and China kicks off, for example, if China were to invade Taiwan, for the United States to respond, they would all unleash all that chaos.
You think it is pre-invasion.
So it's shaping before phase zero is shaping the battlefield environment before the actual kinetic conflict. And their goal is to create psychological panic. And their hope is that by manipulating that panic in the United States, imagine the telecom systems goes down. Imagine your water doesn't come out anymore. Imagine your electric grid goes down. That's going to create mass psychological panic in the United States. And their hope is then to use that against us and say, don't come to Taiwan. Don't fight us because we can hit you hard in the U.S. home.
And we know they have the lasing technology into space.
The what? The what?
Lasing.
Okay.
Capability to take out our GPS as well.
Our satellite system.
And so for our satellite system.
But they'd have to do it one at a time, wouldn't they?
No, not necessarily.
It's likely this would be a mass coordinated attack. Yeah. So they would attack our satellites, but then they would also unleash this malware into our infrastructure.
Right.
And the part, again, about our book is that they laid this foundation through decades of theft. So they've been mapping our systems. They've been embedding into our systems. They've been understanding our weak points, our vulnerabilities. They've been stealing our secrets. And now they have the potential to not just steal secrets, but launch a kinetic effect.
All right, when we come back, does the government know about this? What can they do about it? Are we doing the same to them? And what is their obsession with Taiwan? Why is it such a threat, this small island just off their coast? David Shedd is here. Andrew Badger is here. Their book is doing great. It's out this week. It's called The Great Heist, China's Epic Campaign to Steal America's Secrets. I wish it wasn't true, but we need to all read this book and find out, sadly, that it is. Don't move.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We're back. David Shedd is here. Andrew Badger's here. Their best-selling book, The Great Heist, is out. China's epic campaign to steal America's secrets. And Andrew, let me start with you. What is the Chinese obsession with Taiwan? Why would they worry about Taiwan? I mean, they got so many other challenges. They want to take us on. They're stealing all our stuff. Why do they need to bring them in like they did Hong Kong?
There's a significant historical and cultural attachment to Taiwan. I mean, imagine if a part of the United States had broken off, say, Texas. We'd obviously have that one, that deep desire to reclaim what we see as our divine territory, our manifest destiny and respect. But there's also significant geopolitical advantages. Taiwan was described by General MacArthur, I believe, as a sitting aircraft carrier in the middle of the Pacific. And it sits right at a critical junction point where all the trade routes for our allies, Japan and South Korea, all pass by Taiwan. So if the Chinese conquer Taiwan, it's not just going to be a huge PR victory for the Communist Party, but it'll provide them strategic leverage over some of our most critical allies. And it's personally critical for Xi Jinping's personal own legacy.
David, the other thing is, when you see a thriving capitalistic democracy in Taiwan and the quality of life that they have in that small island, do you think that they hate that, that the Chinese people in mainland China see the quality of life they have in Taiwan and the freedom that they're able to enjoy?
What's interesting is that business drives so many of the relationships between the mainland and Taiwan. And so that there are many from the mainland, and I'm talking about the People's Liberation Army side of things and the Chinese Communist Party, which is really only about 80 million strong out of 1.4 billion people, is that the relationship with the Taiwan citizens is very fluid in both directions. It accounts for about 30 to 35% of the economic trade between both countries. And so there are many in Shanghai and Beijing and Guangzhou who are very attracted to the kind of relationship that exists today. Because, again, there has been a growth in mainland China of the middle class that sees business as business.
What should our listeners know? That what could we do right now? And you're going to be going to government. You're going to be briefing the China Select Committee on China. And they've reached out to you. And they've noticed how great your book is, The Great Heist, and how valuable it is. What are some of the things you'd recommend we do right now?
I think the first thing, right, is we have to identify what are our crown jewels of the 21st century technology. What are our most important critical technologies that we have to protect? First among them is AI, right? Artificial intelligence is going to transform not only economic power but military power. AI can be embedded into missiles.
So these are private companies, though.
These are private companies.
We have to bridge the
most fundamental step is we have to bridge that gap between the public and private sector. And it, most importantly, reframe how we think about economic security. In America, we're separate. We have the private sector. We have government. China has no private sector government. It's all civil-military fusion. Everything's blended together. We have to kind of start thinking about how do we protect our economic security, and we have to think economic security is national security.
Right, so I got that. What else would you recommend?
So when I think back to how my career developed, starting with the Soviet Union in 1982 when I joined CIA, we operated under the National Security Act of 1947, which was the structure in which the U.S. government looked at national security matters in what now 80 years ago you would say be a very traditional form. We advocate for creating a national economic security counsel within the White House under the president ultimately, but really chaired by the vice president, that brings private sector and government, because this is part of our industrial base. The other thing, we need to strengthen and harden our perimeters in the cybersecurity arena in major ways around these protected goals.
We don't have a director of cybersecurity right now in the government. I think that job is open.
It's hard to believe that you have that vacancy in place on something that is so absolutely critical for America in terms of driving that. The other thing, we need legal reform, because the bar is so high on prosecuting these individuals that are involved in economic espionage that many of the companies simply give up. And we need to understand that this is about our national security, back to the National Security Act of 1947.
Right.
So those are several elements. We have seven pillars that are defined in the book and laid out in the epilogue of the book on steps that you can materially take to enhance this. And by the way, they completely comport with the special committee that's looking at this in terms of that. There isn't any conflict in terms of our recommendations. And the beautiful thing is we finally found something that's bipartisan.
And I was going to say that.
I rarely hear people stick up for China. I mean,
how can you?
I always thought we could see who the bad guy was between Russia and Ukraine, but some people are confused by that.
But we do need stronger bipartisan support. So to give you one example, in 2018, President Trump on the Department of Justice set up what's called the China Initiative. So this was a special task force. We're going to go after this China threat. We're going to finally stop them from stealing all of our technology. One of the scalps they got, they arrested a Harvard professor who was a nanotechnology expert. They prosecuted him. So they were having success. Joe Biden shut down that initiative because they were afraid of political correctness. I mean, we were allowing our enemy to steal our secrets, and we shut it down because we were scared of offending people. We spoke to a DOJ insider for our book who was part of that program. He said they did a review. They found no trace of any type of discrimination or what have you, and that program has been shut down since then. We need Democrats and Republicans to support that, and we need to start taking this as serious as it deserves.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think that. Number one, the President Trump saw the threat with the Chinese students. Yeah. You see there's 280,000 here. He's like, let's bring 600,000. It's money, and these institutions need it. But there's a problem, especially you say with these students who get to higher education. They keep their families back there, and they essentially, if they don't want to spy for them, they extort them to say your family's going to pay the price, right?
So the national intelligence law that was passed in 2017 requires, this is in China, requires that every Chinese citizen, whether they're living in China or outside anywhere in the world, or any Chinese business entity, to cooperate with the Chinese Communist Party. And so what you have is this, as the old adage goes, we have our ways. There's that you can cooperate in a manner that is of so-called free will, or we will force that, and they bring the families into the police station and all the rest when they want to do that.
Right, and yet we have to coexist in the meantime while doing everything we can to get rare earth, be responsible ourselves, because they have us over a barrel on that.
Exactly right.
All right, so congratulations, guys, on the book. David Chen and Andrew Badger, The Great Heist is out, China's epic campaign to steal America's secrets, and we'll see you Sunday at 10 o'clock. All right, thanks
Looking
so much, guys.
Thanks, Brian.
I
appreciate it.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Why the fraud got so out of control in Minnesota?
I think what happened is that, you know, when you have these kind of new programs that are designed to help people, and I just think that a lot of the COVID programs that were set up, they were set up so quickly that a lot of the guardrails did not get created.
Oh, really? Isn't that interesting? Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, when her staffer is indicted, when a place where she holds events steals millions upon millions of dollars, and the Somali community is implicated in, I don't know, $1 billion in bilked funds. She doesn't see it as a problem. Congressman Tom Tiffany joins us now. He's chairman of the Federal Lands Committee, member of the Judiciary Committee, and he introduced the CARE Act to give local communities and states the final say on refugee resettlements, which we're going to get to shortly. So, Congressman, I know you're going to be running for governor soon, I think. It looks like you're going to be doing that. So right now, you are your thoughts about what's unfolding in Minnesota.
Well, this has been going on for a number of years. And by the way, give a lot of credit to a bunch at Powerline, Scott Johnson and others, who've been reporting this story for years. And now it's really broken through nationally, where you've had this enormous fraud that has been going on, and to the tune of billions of dollars. But Minnesotans are finally figuring out that they've been funding terrorism, that money has been going to Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And they're just, they can't believe it. They can't believe something like this would happen. And it's part of the problem, Brian, you know, sitting on the Judiciary Committee, people just don't believe us sometimes with the stuff we tell them is going on in the United States of America, whether it's going after Catholics at the Richmond Diocese or stories like this out of Minnesota. And we just got to keep repeating it to them and saying, yeah, this is happening to you. And now we need to fix it.
Well, you know, the thing is, the president of the United States has been very blunt. He says the Somali community is not grateful. I'm going to stop immigration, immigration from Somalia to America. And that is before the terror ties are really unfolded and confirmed. So let's say that just the fact that all this money is gone and Ilhan Omar is pretty much the leader in that area, certainly that community, and the AG, Keith Ellison, and Governor Walz pleads ignorance to it. Are there going to be any consequences to this type of grift?
Well, there is consequences for some of those that are followers of Ilhan Omar and others, in that they are going to jail. I mean, give Joe Thompson, the acting U.S. attorney, an enormous amount of credit, because he has went after this day after day for years now, making the case, and they are now sending people to prison, which is a good thing. But I mean, when you have somebody like Ilhan Omar, who declares her allegiance to Somalia, I mean, she said publicly at events that her first allegiance is to Somalia. I don't know what you can do about that, other than we do need to shut down immigration. And I think we need to bring back the public charge, Brian, that we had, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, that you cannot come into America unless you agree to assimilate. You cannot be a public charge on the American people. And you need a sponsor to make the case that you will not become a public charge. I think we need to go back to the good old days in terms of handling immigration in that way that we know people want to become Americans.
Yeah, that's key. We don't care where you're from. What can you? How can you help our country? There's nothing wrong with that. I want you to hear what Keith Ellison said yesterday when confronted with this. Cut 42. He's the attorney general.
I mean, critics have said the state officials, including you and the governor, did not act fast enough or quickly enough to investigate charges of fraud against the Feeding Our Future and did a little. Is there something you wish you had done differently?
No, we cooperated fully and worked well with the FBI. We're glad that we took the action that we did. I convicted over 300 people in the last few years for Medicaid fraud. So we are very able to go after fraud, and we do all the time.
So, I mean, this guy's got no regrets.
Yeah, Keith Ellison is not the person to be held up as the exemplar
ever
of upholding law and order in the United States, and including in many Minnesota. So first of all, I would fact check everything that he says, because who knows if the truth is coming out of his mouth. He looked the other way. He could have followed through on this. There is money that is going into campaign coffers as a direct result of all this fraud that has went on, and they turned a blind eye to it.
Some of it's caught on tape. So in Wisconsin, you're refusing to learn, you say, the lessons of Minnesota on this fraud scandal. You sent a letter to Governor Tony Evers on an audit request for SNAP funds and awareness. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so what you see happening in Minnesota, I don't think it's at the same scale in Wisconsin. But Brian, if you take a look at what we've been revealing out federally at the states of the enormous amount of call them improper payments that have been going out for Medicaid and programs like that, SNAP also. I think it's time for every state to look at their roles and give credit to Secretary Brooke Rollins this week, who said that we're going to ask each of the states to provide their data so that we can review it and make sure that only people who are deserving of these programs are on them. without a doubt, we are going to find some fraud in Wisconsin. It may not be anywhere near the scale it is in Minnesota, but isn't any fraud too much fraud?
Absolutely. So let's talk about, too, your concern, in light especially of the DC shooting that killed one National Guards member. She lost her life, and another is holding on to his, thankfully making some slight progress. From an Afghani who was brought here after the horrendous exit from that country. You have concerns in Wisconsin. What are you guys dealing with?
Yeah, so we've introduced something called the CARE Act now that allows local governments to be able, local people, to be able to decide whether they want refugees or not. I mean, why should a local community have their entire culture turned upside down because the federal government, under, in this case, President Biden, who really didn't care where these people went, he just wanted to jam them in the United States of America. Why shouldn't local people have some say of what's going to happen to their local community? Because they were trying to do that in Western Wisconsin, the community of Eau Claire, and the Eau Claire City Council, who was like-minded with President Biden, they tried to sweep it under the rug and just say, no, nothing to see here. Once it got blown up by people like myself and local people on the ground, there was outrage that why are you trying to jam in all these people that are coming from third world countries into our community and changing the very fabric of our community?
Is there any supervision? I mean, if there's any report, is there any, they're just put into your state? I'm sure other states can say the same thing. Is there any type of security?
Yeah, it's just the federal government has sole authority in regards to this. They can put people wherever they want to. There is no state or local control. So our bill just says that state and local governments should have a say whether they want to have these refugees come into their local communities. I mean, I hate to say it, but when the Afghan pullout happened back, you know, what was it, August of 2021, over 4 years ago, I told the Biden administration before they launched the first plane out of Kabul, do not do this, because these people in the terrorism hotbed of the world have to go. They should be going through something called a special immigrant visa process. They did not do that. They just said, get them on the planes. We'll sort out the immigration stuff later. That was a quote from the State Department. And when I went to Fort McCoy, one of the bases here in Wisconsin that brought in 13,000 of them, I was there for the first 2,000, asked the base commander, did you go through the SIV process with these people? Did the State Department do that? And they said, no, we did not. In fact, they would let them, Brian, walk off the base without any supervision.
And what's the situation like now, today?
So all of them have been processed and put in other parts of the country, including in Wisconsin. But we should go back and review all those people, and they should have to go through the special immigrant visa process after what happened in Washington, D.C. to those two West Virginia National Guard members. We can't allow this to happen again in America.
So, Congressman, when it comes to holding on to your majority in the House, everyone says it's affordability. That's going to be the key. Even Democrats say it's affordability. Here's Chuck Schumer, cut one.
Lawrence, he is in such an effing bubble that he doesn't even know what average people go through. He's a billionaire. He doesn't worry about paying for groceries. I don't know if he's ever been in a grocery store.
Our country is far too expensive. Donald Trump and Republicans promised to lower costs on day one. Costs haven't gone down. Costs have gone up across the board.
How do you feel about their description of the economy 10 months into the Trump term?
So first of all, Chuck Schumer, the hamburger flipper that doesn't even know enough to put the cheese on until the hamburger is cooked through thoroughly, is lecturing Donald Trump about not being in tune with the average American person. So I look at gasoline prices up where I live. We are down to $2.50 a gallon now.
Wow.
That's the lowest it's been in over 4 years. We are at the leading edge now of getting control of costs in dealing with the inflation that was a result of the previous 4 years. And you can't turn that ship around in just 9 or 10 months, but it is beginning to turn. And I agree with Secretary Bessent. You watch in 2026, as more money goes into people's pockets, as we get you know, lower energy prices, which is a large part of what drives inflation, as we bring those energy costs down, I think you're going to see 2026 be a good year for the American people.
So, Congressman, what is with the arguing in your party? I'm watching Nancy Mace argue and say, I might quit, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I don't like Donald Trump anymore, I'm quitting. We have Elise Stefanik warring with the speaker. Bring us behind closed doors. What's happening with Republicans?
Oh, you know, people always have their agendas. They call it herding cats for a reason. I think Mike Johnson's done a good job of leading us. And I was someone that did not support him at the start. I mean, I ended up voting for him. I mean, I wasn't his strongest supporter. But I got to tell you, I think Mike Johnson's done a good job of leading us with this very narrow majority. And we've gotten some good legislation done, including the Working Families Bill. So, you know, people have their agendas. The main thing is that we continue to get these majority votes, even with the slim majority we have, and move the interests of the American people. People will chatter all day long. It's what people do with their votes that matters.
So you're running for governor. Is that official?
Yeah, I announced 2 months ago.
So 2 months ago, you're running for governor. Will you be running? Would Evers, is he term limited out?
He's chosen, no term limits in Wisconsin. He chose not to run for reelection. And appropriately so. Wisconsin's educational system, which he used to be the head of, or the secretary of the Department of Public Instruction, is in free fall. 47% of first graders only 47% can read at grade level in first grade. We are in free fall. We've fallen behind the state of Mississippi in educational attainment. He's leaving a sinking ship. We are going to fix it. We're going to set higher educational standards, and we're going to stop the indoctrination and educate our kids.
All right, Congressman Tom Tiffany. He wants to be Governor Tom Tiffany, but meanwhile, he wants to get a lot done this next year. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Have a fantastic weekend.
TomTiffany.com, at TomTiffanyWI. You can find me, Brian.
Absolutely, I will, and I'll look you up. Good luck, Tom. We're going to be right back to finish up this hour. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. The President of the United States is now on the floor of the Kennedy Center. Why? He's going to be part of the picking of the teams and setting up of the groups. It's the big World Cup draw. What they expect to have 1 billion people watching around the world. Among those people watching are there in person, Kevin Hart, Tom Brady, the Village People, Bocelli, who's not in the Village People. I'm sure he'd love to be. More of that in just a moment. You're listening to Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
I think the crowd is great, and I think the building is great. We've made a lot of improvements over the last 6 months. Taking Kennedy Center was in very bad shape. Now it's getting to be really good, and in 6 months it's going to be incredible, the improvements we've made.
First time for the U.S. to host since the 90s. You ready for it?
I'm ready for it, and they're ready for it. And Johnny, who you know, has done a fantastic job with FIFA. And we're looking to have, you know, we have already set records with ticket sales. I don't think there's ever been anything like it in any sport. Yeah. And so I want to congratulate you. I mean, I don't even have to wait. But major records have been set.
So with the President of the United States moments ago on the red carpet with the great Bill Malusian, along with Gianni Infantino, who's head of FIFA, president of FIFA, the president today has found out they've come up with a new piece, a World Cup Peace Award that's going to be given out every World Cup. That's every 4 years. And if they came up with it right after the president did not get the Nobel Peace Prize, my sense is he's going to get it today. And when asked about that a little bit later, he came out and said, I'm not here to win prizes. I'm here to bring peace, which is a great answer. But he's really into doing that. And he said, we got 8 wars settled. Yesterday, the Congo and Rwanda official. And he wants 9, but I think that Russia is a long way away. Russia and Ukraine. Now, Ukraine is coming to town again and going to meet to follow up on what happened behind closed doors for 5 hours, I think maybe even longer in Russia. But what Russia is doing now is something interesting. They feel like they're winning. I mean, and they feel like this. Get this. They are now telling Vladimir Putin reiterated his commitment to his original war aims of 2021, which, by the way, have epically failed, and unwilling to compromise during an interview with India's media, like India. That's where he is right now. Other Kremlin officials, they say, likely as part of Kremlin's efforts to shape the negotiations. Let's hope.
The Kremlin is doing this. This is going to drive you crazy, Eric. You ready? The Kremlin is setting conditions to frame out any future agreement. And this is their conditions: to not attack Odessa and Mykolaiv, which are cities that Russia wants, would not attack as a concession. So get this. I promise not to take any more of your land if you go to peace. So I'm not going to take too many cities. But if you don't, I'm going to start rocketing and taking your country. Think about that. That's how warped this guy is. Believe me, the place is falling apart from the inside. They've lost more intellectual capital. People have just left. They're down by millions of people who are no longer want to be drafted part of this war. They have to grab them from outside. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces have advanced in, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4 separate cities. Russian forces advanced in another 4 cities, separate cities from that. So they're still moving. These lines are still going back and forth. What I would like to do is say, hey, Zelensky, pay us later. Here are the Patriots. Hey, Zelensky, you can grab 36 Tomahawks and you can start working on it. And that'll get you. That'll get Vladimir Putin used to some type of peace. It looks like Macron feels like he's left out. He's made a statement that he thinks America's going to sell out Ukraine. And now he's, I don't know if he's going or just calling. He's asking China to help him out. Nice, right? Macron, who fancies himself a power broker, whose government has fallen apart, I think, 5 times in a year, who really has no control of about a third of his country. Lastly, this point. Zohar Mamdani was called out about Netanyahu yesterday. Are you going to arrest him? Here's Netanyahu when asked about, is he afraid to come to New York? Cut 55.
I'll come to New York. Okay.
And that was my question. Would you come to New York, given what the mayor has said about arresting you?
Yes, of course I will.
And you will test that? I mean, what is the thought about how that would work?
Well, why don't you wait and see? Yes, I'll come to New York.
Would you want to talk to him, by the way?
Well, you know, if he changes his mind and says that we have the right to exist, that'll be a good opening for a conversation.
Yeah. No one in Israel can believe that we elected this guy in New York City. I know. Neither can I. By the way, no one wants to do. Make sure we don't clear out homeless encampments. Even Gavin Newsom is clearing out homeless encampments. We're in for quite a ride. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget to watch me Sunday night, 10 o'clock, right here on Fox News Channel, One Nation.